All right, a quick review. Remember that the people of Israel had clamored for a king. They had been under a series of judges for 400 years. And since Moses had brought them out of Egypt, and then Joshua brought them into the land of promise, and finally they had asked for a king. They wanted to be like the nations around them, and the judge that they had at the time, Samuel, who was one of the great heroes of Israel, had explained to them the situation, and God said, go ahead and give them what they want, but make sure they know what they're getting themselves into. And then God gave them a king by the name of Saul. Saul started well, but did not finish well. Saul rebelled against the Lord on two different occasions, and God had told him that not only would his dynasty not continue, in other words, his son would not become king, that his line of kings would end with him, but also that the kingdom would be taken away from him and given to somebody else who would obey the Lord. And God raised up a young fella, a teenage boy by the name of David, to be the king. Now, when David was anointed king, the only people that knew about it, as far as we know from the scripture, is David's brothers, the prophet Samuel, and that's it. Saul didn't know who the replacement was going to be, and he's still king, and he's going to hang on to that position for all he can. I mean, he's not going to let go of that, even though he knows that God has said, you've disqualified yourself. Instead of submitting to that and saying, God, show us the man that you would have, I will step out and let him step in, which would be a position of obedience, a position of submission to what the Lord has decreed. Instead, he's going to hang on to his power, which is standard operating procedure for people. People, once they get in a position of power, are very, very apprehensive about letting that go. They're going to hang on to that as long as they possibly can. And so Saul has been looking over his shoulder for probably a number of years, looking for that potential replacement that God has raised up. And he suspects that it's David. David came in originally as a court musician, and then we had the David and Goliath situation. Now remember, the whole David and Goliath thing, David is still a teenager when that happened probably. He's probably 16, 17 years of age, not very old, and he suddenly overnight became a hero. And ends up becoming not just the court musician, but also part of the military as this young guy. And almost certainly a number of years have gone by. He's now in his early 20s. And he is now one of the captains in the army. He's probably the number four guy in the government there in Israel. And yet he's still a very young man. He is doing everything he's supposed to do. He's staying out of trouble. He's doing exactly what the king requires of him. And as a result, promises that Saul made, he ends up marrying the king's daughter. And that wasn't really what Saul wanted. What Saul wanted was for David to get killed, earning the right to be the king's son-in-law. But instead, David fulfills the requirement and ends up becoming part of the family. And it's like, you can imagine Saul smiling in public and in private, pulling his hair out. It's like, how can I get rid of this guy? Because he tries, and finally he resorts to several efforts of overt confrontation. In other words, I am going to kill this fellow myself. And in a rage, he throws a spear at David, and David is able to bob and weave and get out of the way and escape. And then Saul sends some military people, some guards, whatever, to David's house at night to apprehend him in the morning and to have him killed the next day. Because remember, there's no electric lights and stuff. It's dark, so we can escape during the night. So they're going to wait till daybreak to get in there and get him. And David knows about this. And as a result, his wife urges him, and he escapes through a window by a rope. And he's on the run. Now, David, poor guy, he doesn't know what's going on. Why is the king trying to kill me? And Jonathan, who remembers the hero of 1 Samuel, Jonathan is the king's son. He's the guy that would be king. But Jonathan is a jewel. Jonathan is a guy who is yielded to what God would have him to be. He is willing to let David be king and for him not to be. He is already, you know, David would have him be the captain of the army or something like that, put him in a high position. But he understands that God has decreed that he won't be king. And so he says, okay, I will submit to what God has decreed. And so when David is escaping, he goes a couple of different places, but he goes to see Jonathan. And Jonathan is saying, listen, my dad would not try to kill you without telling me. And David says, listen, your dad knows that you and I have a covenant together and we're tight friends. And he would not tell you because he does not want to grieve you. And therefore he's doing this without letting you know. And so Jonathan says, all right, David, how can I help you? What do you want me to do? Because David's still trying to figure out what in the world is going on. And is Saul really, is this just a fit of rage, or is this, you know, an ongoing effort that if I show up and it doesn't matter what the circumstances are, he's gonna want to kill me. So they developed their plan, and this is what, and they made a promise to each other that to after David becomes king, regardless of the circumstances, David would not wipe out Jonathan's descendants, which was standard operating procedure. When you have a new dynasty come in, the new king would wipe out all the potential rivals from the other dynasty. And David made a promise to Jonathan that he would not wipe out Jonathan's offspring, his descendants. So, we have the proposal of a test. So he says there in verse 4 of 1 Samuel chapter 20, then said Jonathan unto David, whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee. Whatever you want, I'll do. You say it, you name it, I'll do it. So here's the test. Verse 5, David said unto Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon. That would be when the moon is the opposite of a full moon. And I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. There's an annual banquet there at the palace. I'm supposed to be there because I'm one of the chief captains of the kingdom. I'm supposed to be there. And if I'm not, then we got a potential problem. I need to be there. It is expected, it is required of me to be there. I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. But let me go. Now, remember, Jonathan is number two guy in the kingdom. David is at least number four and maybe further down than that, but Jonathan's number two. So, let me go, and I will hide in the field. I'm going to be, you know, where no one can locate me. Until the third day. So I'm not only going to be gone tomorrow, but I'm going to be gone for 3 days. And what you're going to do, and what you're going to say is, if your father misses me, verse 6, say, well, David earnestly asked leave of me. He asked permission that he might run to Bethlehem, his home city, his hometown. For there is a yearly sacrifice there with all the family. A perfectly legitimate excuse. So, if Saul says anything, say, well, David asked permission and I gave him leave to go to Bethlehem for an annual family sacrifice. And if he says, okay, sounds good to me, thy servant shall have peace. In other words, it's not a problem. But, if he's angry, then be sure that evil is determined by him. So Saul's reaction to this will determine whether or not Saul is, because it'll be evident, Saul's going to say something and give himself away. If Saul says, oh, that's all right, I understand, there's no problem. But if Saul flies into a rage, then we know we got a problem. So, they also, how is Jonathan going to notify David? Because David's going to be in hiding. So, Jonathan says, let's do this. We're going to go out in the field and I know you're going to be in this area somewhere hiding. And I'm going to go out with my bow and arrow, and I'll have a servant boy with me. And I will make as if I am shooting at a target. And then I'll send the boy to go get the arrows that I've shot. Because, you know, they weren't super cheap. You couldn't just go to Walmart and buy arrows. Somebody had to make these things. And so if I say the arrow is past where the boy is, that means my father is going to try to kill you. But if I say, you know, is it over here, then everything's good to go. And so they go out and do this, and Jonathan learns of his father's intentions. Look at verse 24. So, the day has come for the feast, where David is supposed to be there in the court, in the palace. Verse 24. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat down to eat meat, to eat his meal. And the king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon the seat by the wall, the position where the king normally sat. Why would a king sit next to the wall?
Nobody could be behind him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a place of safety. Nobody's sneaking up behind me because I'm right next to the wall. And Jonathan arose. So Jonathan's there. Abner sat by the king's side. Who's Abner? He's the captain of the army. He's the number three guy after Jonathan. And David's seat was empty. David's got his own spot there at the table, and David's seat is empty. Nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day. Didn't mention it. For he thought, surely something has befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. What does that mean? Does it mean that he, you know, got all muddy? What does that mean if he's not clean?
Impure.
Okay, he is ceremonially impure. Remember, they're operating under the law of Moses. This is Old Testament. Which means that several things could have happened, one of which would be if David had touched a dead body, he would have to be ceremonially unclean until the next day. He would wash and go through a process, and then he would be clean the next day. So he's figuring something happened. He's got a legitimate... Now, it's very interesting. Saul assumes that David is going to do what's right. If David's not here, then he was providentially hindered, because I can count on David to always do the right thing. David is supposed to be here, and if he's not here, then there must be a legitimate reason for him not to be here. Because David always does what he's supposed to do. That's been Saul's experience. Which makes it even crazier as far as Saul is concerned, because here's a guy who always does the right thing, I can count on him to do the right thing, and yet I want to bump him off. And it came to pass, verse 27, on the morrow, next day, David again is supposed to be there. And David's place was empty. And Saul leans over and says to his son Jonathan, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet yesterday or today? Where's David? Probably just inquiring about that tone. Where's David? And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem for the sacrifice and so forth. And so I gave him leave. Therefore, he cometh not to the king's table. Now, that was going to be the test. If Saul said, oh, okay, then everything's fine. But if he goes into a rage, then what's the issue? You look out, because Saul is going to be... The issue is not just... It's not like a we're going to guess. If he's angry, then that means I'm in trouble. But Saul's going to give himself away, and he does. Because people in a rage say and do things they wouldn't do normally. And so Saul goes into a rage, and he gives himself away. Look, verse 30. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He blew a gasket. And said unto him, thou son of a perverse, rebellious woman... So he cussed out his son. Do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and under the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? So he's chewing him out, saying that you are preferring David over your father. For as long as the son of Jesse, that's David, as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. So you will not be king. As long as David's alive, Jonathan, you will never be king. Well, Jonathan knows that. And he has submitted to that. But Saul has not. Wherefore, send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. Well, there he's given it all away. In one verse, he's given it all away. Or two verses. And so Jonathan, thus far, has kept his composure, which, you know, if somebody's yelling and screaming and cussing you out, it's a little difficult, but he maintains his composure. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said, wherefore shall he be slain? What has he done? Because there wasn't anything. You couldn't lay your finger. There was nothing that David had done. It was simply the threat that here's the guy who's going to be my replacement. Here's the guy that God had already told. It isn't David's ambition, it's the decree of God. God has said it's not going to be Jonathan, and it's not going to be Saul, it's going to be David. So the whole issue is not David. The issue is what? If they're rebelling against God. Jonathan, or Saul rather, is rebelling against God. Now, sometimes God does things that we don't like, or sometimes he does things we don't understand. But here's something as a pastor, and you folks are probably aware of this as well in your own observation stuff. When a tragedy happens in a life, could be a health issue, could be a house fire, could be just, you know, family falling apart, any number of things. When a tragedy happens in a family, for Christian people, and sometimes even not for Christian people, people who are quasi-religious, you know. You get one of two responses. Either people will turn to the Lord and seek for grace to endure and help to remedy the situation, or people get angry. And who are they angry with? They're angry at God. God, how could you allow this to happen? And understand that when you're in the midst of a tragedy, and sometimes things get worse before they get better, but when you're in the midst of a tragedy, as God's child, if you know Christ as Savior, if you are God's child, that we're in the middle of this. And when we're in the middle of the trial and the difficulty, all we can see is the trouble. We don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. All we can see is problems everywhere. And what is our response? Well, if we take the anger route, we get frustrated, we get discouraged, we get depressed, and we want to vent and blame. Because most people don't just go, oh well. Very few people do. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't anybody that does that. Most people don't just go, oh well. People want to vent. They want to blame. We see this in the news all the time. Some great tragedy happens. Something happens somewhere. Well, we've got to find a fall guy. We've got to find somebody to blame for what's going on. You know, we had the bridge collapse up in Skagit County over the river. Whose fault was it? It's that truck driver. No, wait a minute. We checked and that bridge has been hit a whole bunch of times. Well, then the problem is trucks. We've got to blame the trucks. But what about the design of the bridge in the first place? What about the fact that it's just old and needs to be fixed? No, we got to find somebody to blame. It's somebody's fault that this happened. Okay, people want to try to find somebody to blame for their circumstances. And we do this personally. It's somebody's fault when a tragedy happens. And if you can't find somebody to say, well, you messed up. It's your fault. If you can't do that, then what do you do? People blame God. God, how could you allow this to happen? And even if you can point at a human being, people still blame God. Understand that as God's children, you've heard the verse over and over again in these circumstances, so much so that pastors have a tendency not to want to use it. But Romans 8:28 is true. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. That God is doing what is ultimately in our best interest. Now, when we're surrounded by the tragedy, we can't see what's going to be happening in 6 months or a year or 5 years. And most of us have been through enough trials and difficulties in our life so that we can look back at that tragedy and we can see the good that God used to as a result of this. Sometimes we go through a situation to give us help in being able to minister to somebody else down the road. Now, I know you guys, so a lot of you guys think I'm a young guy. And I go to the hospital to try to comfort somebody. I have never had surgery in my life. I've never had a broken bone that I'm aware of. I think I had a broken rib once when I was a kid, but I don't know. But I have had a kidney stone. I've had more than one, as a matter of fact. And I walk into the ER, and the nurse says, he has a kidney stone. My wife says, how do you know? She says, he has the look. ER nurses will tell you that one of the greatest distresses of pain that people endure when they come into an ER is not the broken bone or something like that. It's the kidney stone. Now, I don't care to go through that again. But I'll tell you what, having gone through that, where I couldn't say more than one or two words. I just couldn't get a sentence out. I was just in agony. And having been there, that gives me a great deal of sympathy for the person in the hospital bed when I go to do a call. That helped my ministry to be able to help other people. Again, I'm not real crazy about the schooling I got, but there was a great good that came from that. And thankfully, it didn't have any lasting problems. I had that little window of agony. But looking back at it, that was helpful to me.
Something good came from something bad.
That's right. God uses trials and I could cite a number of different things, some of the things that you folks are connected with. How God turned a tragedy, a trial, a great just disaster, that's how it was seen at the time, into a great blessing. And so people respond differently. And Saul is in a rage. And Jonathan is keeping his temper thus far. And Saul says, you will never be established in your kingdom. Well, Jonathan knows that. Jonathan has submitted himself to that. Saul has not. People like to leave a legacy. I need to do something so that when I am gone, people, I will have done something that will last beyond my lifetime. And right now, Saul's legacy is one disaster after another. So wherefore shall he be slain? What has he done? Now, verse 33. Oh, man, this is just amazing to me. Verse 33. And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him. Once in a while, you'll read a news account where, if you're a police officer, what is the call that you don't want to have to respond to?
Domestic
violence. Why? Because people are out of their gourds. They are in a rage and they do not respond rationally. And people who, under normal circumstances, would love one another are going to do almost amazing things. We had a double murder that happened within about a mile of where we are right now, or right over here, where a dad killed his two adult children who were living in the home with him. Now, getting some background and some of the news stories, he had done everything to try to help two prodigal children. And there was constant fighting and fighting and fighting. And finally, he popped. He went into a rage and bumped them both off. People do screwy things when they go into a rage. And so Jonathan's the guy that Saul wants to replace him as king. And so what does Saul do in his rage? Tries to kill him. Now, Jonathan, or Saul had just said in the previous verse that Jonathan was supposed to be king and he wants him to be king, and now he's going to try to kill him. Because he's angry. He's venting. He's responding irrationally, which has been what Saul's been doing for a while.
Complete insanity.
Yes. And so whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to kill David. Now, Jonathan, does Jonathan maintain his composure? Somewhat, I think. He does pretty well under the circumstances. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger. He is just seething mad. And he didn't eat no meat the second day of the month. He's fasting. In his rage, he got up, left the meal before it was served. For he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. Done David shame and done Jonathan shame. All Saul is doing is reinforcing for everybody else to see what God had already decreed. Remember the issue. Man seeth the outside, but God sees the inside. Saul's a big strapping guy. He's this much taller than everybody else. He, remember, he says he was a head taller than everybody else. The guy's almost 7 feet tall, probably. He's a great, big, huge guy. He had won lots of victories for Israel. Israel had to deal with the Philistines and the Ammonites and some others, and God had given him victory, and so the kingdom's established, and he's done some good things as far as politics are concerned. But there's something wrong on the inside. He is self-willed. It's all about me. And he is not in submission to God. And so he flies into a rage. And David is grieved. The clearing of the table. So they go back out next day. Verse 35. Came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David. Now, he doesn't see where David is. He just knows that David's in the area. David's hiding. Remember, David grew up as a shepherd boy, so he knows how to live out in the fields. And he had a little lad with him, a little boy with him. And he said unto the lad, run, find now the arrows that I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow way past the boy. And when the lad was come to the place where the arrow Jonathan shot, Jonathan cried after the lad, is not the arrow beyond thee? And he called the boy back, and after he gathered the arrows, he says in verse 39, but the lad knew not anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter, because that was the code that they had devised. I love this in the King James, verse 40, and Jonathan gave his artillery, which if you look up what it was originally, that's in 1611 when this was put together, that's what it was. Give his artillery unto the lad and said, go carry them into the city. So Jonathan is out there in the field, as far as the boy knows, by himself. And as soon as the boy was gone, David rose out of his place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times, and they kissed one another, which was, like I said, I have relatives in French Canada, and I go to visit my cousin, Jonathan. Mwah! Mwah! All right. And you still see this in a lot of places. It's like, because that isn't how we operate. But that's how they operate in a lot of places around the world, and that's what they did in the Middle East back in that day. It was a greeting. And they wept one upon the other until David exceeded. They know, no words have to be said. They know what's going on. They know why. David has suspected this very strongly for a long time. Jonathan, it's just been right over his head. He didn't see it. He didn't understand it until the day before. So now Jonathan knows. And it grieves him because the two people in the world he loves the most, one is trying to kill the other. David is fleeing for his life. And Jonathan doesn't know how it's all going to come about. Saul is in rebellion against God, and he knows that. And so Jonathan is caught between a rock and a hard place as far as his allegiance is concerned, but he's going to do what's right. He's going to serve his father as long as it doesn't require him doing something to David. And we'll see that right up to the end of Jonathan's life. But what's going to happen with David? Where's David going to go? What's going to happen next? Because Jonathan now knows that Saul's going to try to kill him. David's going to be, is not going to be back to the court. That's the end of it. David's on the run and will be. And so Jonathan knows that he may or may not ever see David again. Now we do know, we'll find out later on that he's going to see him at least one more time. But, you know, here's a young man that has been like a son or a brother to me. And now, due to circumstances beyond both, the relationship is still good, but I can't fellowship and interact with my best friend because of the wickedness of my father. And so he's really in a bind. And like I said, Jonathan's the hero of 1 Samuel. He is going to do what's right. He is going to do what's right. David so far is doing what's right, but we're going to see David make a few stumbles along the way before we get to the end of the book. But Jonathan is the hero. And Jonathan is going to, he's got to do this balancing act of serving my father without resorting to wickedness. And sometimes that's hard. Sometimes we're in a job situation where my boss makes requirements of me that are wrong, and I can't submit to that. So how do I do what's right and yet still please my boss? Sometimes we find ourselves in a situation that in a family. Sometimes you may have an unsaved spouse, and there's demands that are made that how do I balance between obeying my spouse and not doing wrong? And sometimes it's a juggling act, but you have to make sure that you cleave to the Lord. And the Lord never puts us in a no-win situation. 1 Corinthians 10:13, there hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. Everybody's got to deal with it. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape.
What if the boss asked you to do something wrong against the Lord, you could get fired, I guess, for not.
But you know what? That's one of those situations where all you see is the tragedy. But God will take care of you. But my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ. If you have to quit, you have to quit. If you get fired, then you get fired.
If it's wrong, then you should.
God always has first place. I will do what's right regardless of what it costs me. And God will make a way for you to do what is right. Okay. And it might be hard. And make sure that you understand that sometimes there's a difference between doing what I want to do and doing what's right. I may be convinced that I shouldn't do this because that's wrong. But sometimes it's a matter of, I don't want to do this because I don't want to do this.
What if you're in the military?
Again, you have to make a decision.
You have to put to service?
If they were to ask you to do something that is wrong, then you'd have to do that. You know, there's a dilemma right now with some of the requirements, and it's all still up in the air right now, but some of the requirements that the higher-ups are demanding of the chaplains. Some of the chaplains are wondering how long they'll be able to stay in the chaplaincy.
They'll get a dishonorable discharge.
Not necessarily. They can get a conscientious, yeah. But they'll have to leave the service. But this is all up in the air right now.
Is that happening?
It's in the works. We'll see what happens. There are some who have left. But understand also that Bible-believing chaplains, gospel-preaching chaplains are...
rare.
No, they're actually overrepresented. Because the liberals don't want to go into this. The liberals go into... If you have a liberal chaplain, often it's a guy who couldn't make it as a pastor. And so you end up with these ne'er-do-well chaplains. And then you have a few of them that are hardworking, conscientious. But the Bible-believers go into it because they figure here's a ministry opportunity. And one of the benefits, and John, help me out if I'm wrong here, but one of the benefits of the Bible-believing chaplains is they actually interact with the men. Instead of hanging out at the officers' club, they actually try to minister to the guys. And they're seeing people saved. I've known a, matter of fact, we had a chaplain visited here. He's out at Fort Lewis right now, I think. He's a fundamental Baptist. And he got back from Afghanistan, I think, this past fall. And he got in trouble with his higher ups for being so overtly evangelistic, trying to win the fellows to Christ. Because, you know, you're supposed to do the walk the tightrope of being politically correct. Well, he's not going to be politically correct. He's going to tell people the gospel. So they got in trouble for it. But you know what? I won this number of people to Christ along the way. He says, you know, if I suffer consequences and don't get my promotion and so on, so be it. I'm having an effective ministry. But sometimes you may suffer some, you may miss out on a promotion or something else, but it's the cost of doing what's right. But God will always meet the need along the way. All right, we gotta close in prayer. Father, help us to make up our minds that we're gonna do what's right regardless of the cost. And Father, sometimes we're in the middle of just going, suffering for doing right. And may we not grow frustrated or discouraged, Father, understanding that it is more important to please God than to please men. And Father, that you will reward us in the long run. And Father, you will give us the strength and the grace to endure hardship along the way. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.